Hi everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and thank you for joining me today for another exciting conversation on What Women Must Know. This is a program that explores conversations in depth and empowers you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. For those of you who may be new to the show, well, first of all, I'd like to welcome you. And secondly, I'd like to invite you to go up to my website, What Women Must Know, get my free reports. If you do that, you'll find my radio shows will be sent to you each week. And also, I have a wonderful Facebook page that I post on a daily basis, great information, and that's What Women Must Know as well. So keep getting educated, keep getting up to date with the latest and most truthful information so you truly can find your way to the best solutions for yourself. Well, today we're going to have a fantastic conversation because it's a topic that I just love to learn about and to explore and to focus on in my own life, and that's about our brain and the kind of the latest research that is helping us to understand more about the huge potential that lies within our brain. So for years, science has thought that there was no way to halt the death of brain cells, and particularly those brain cells that control our aging process. But recent neuroscience has actually discovered that we can grow new brain cells at any point in our lives. When the rate of this new brain cell growth called neurogenesis is low, that's when we experience memory loss, cognitive deficits, anxiety, stress, depression, and lowered immunity. But when those rates are high, we flourish and we can rapidly learn. We have mental acuity, we have emotional resilience, and we have great health and a whole lot more. So to help us explore this world of our expanding brain potential, I have a wonderful guest today. He is Dr. Brant Courtwright. And let me just say a little bit about Dr. Courtwright. He is a highly respected clinical psychologist and professor of psychology at California Institute of Integral Studies. His consulting practice specializes in cutting-edge brain health and neuroscience-informed depth therapy. He is the author of two previous books, and he lives in San Francisco. He is also the author of The Neurogenesis Diet and Lifestyle, Upgrade Your Brain, Upgrade Your Life. So we're going to be upgrading our lives and our brains today in this conversation, and it's such a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Brant Courtwright to the show today. Hello, Dr. Courtwright.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for making the time. I'm sure you have a really busy practice going there in San Francisco, so I so appreciate you've given us some of your valuable time today, and particularly because this really is an exciting topic. I love anything that helps me expand and grow my brain, and maybe that's a really good place to start. Why do we want to have this thing called neurogenesis? And maybe explain it a little bit more to my listeners.
Yeah, good. So as you were saying, it used to be thought that our brain stopped growing new brain cells when we were in our early 20s. And after that, it was just one slow die-off. But about 16, 17 years ago, neuroscience discovered that actually, no, the brain makes new brain cells throughout our entire lifetime. Now, there's a slowdown in the rate of neurogenesis in middle age and another slowdown in old age. But it turns out that these slowdowns do not need to happen. And it also turns out, like as you were saying, that the rate of neurogenesis, that is, the rate at which our brain produces new brain cells or generates new neurons, is a major biomarker of health, and particularly brain health. It's probably the most important biomarker for brain health that most people have never heard of. So it turns out that just about everybody can increase their rate of neurogenesis by five times, whether it's in in our 20s or 30s, or whether we're in our 40s or 50s or 60s, if we're in late life, we can increase our rate of neurogenesis by 3 to 5 times. And since that research was done, they've discovered a number of new nutrients that raise our rate of neurogenesis. So actually the science is kind of behind on this. We don't even know the upper limits of what's possible. We just know that high rates of neurogenesis are associated with cognitive enhancement, with rapid learning, and with this robust emotional resilience. They did this one study with mice where they gave them what they called an enriched environment, consisting of things like running wheels to exercise on and a great diet, lots of novel environments to explore and nesting materials and lots of other friendly mice to play with and mate with. And they found that their rate of neurogenesis increased by 5 times, and that these high neurogenesis rate mice were, they weren't quite super mice, but almost. It's like they had big cognitive advantages over their normal neurogenesis rate peers. And they also had big emotional advantages over their normal neurogenesis rate peers. And this world that we live in is so neurotoxic. There are so many things in our environment, in our food, in our ways of relating to the world that we all just have grown up in innocently. We've all just stumbled into this innocently. The result has been that about all of us are operating well below our potential, that our brain is operating significantly below what it needs to. And just in the past few years, neuroscience has discovered that, lo and behold, we can upgrade our brain and therefore every level of our life, right? That everything we experience through the brain. So every physical sensation, every emotion, every thought, even every spiritual experience, we experience it through the brain. And so a low-quality brain, which just about all of us have to some degree, is going to result in a lower quality of life. And so this book is really about increasing our rate of neurogenesis so that we can bring about a higher quality of living at every level.
So when you say neurogenesis, is it just the growth of new brain cells, or is there something else that neurogenesis covers as well?
No, that's what it means. It means the birth of new brain cells.
And
go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just going to say, because, I mean, that's the revolutionary discovery that is making such amazing breakthroughs in brain research is, you know, we were all taught, at least when we went to school, that what you've got in terms of brain cells is it. And you kill them, you destroy them, you have bad habits, and you just keep losing your brain cells, and that was the end of it. But that's not true.
That's right. That's right. It's a game changer in terms of the brain. Mm. Now, we've known about neuroplasticity for some time, and that's where current brain cells grow new connections. And so the brain can heal itself after a stroke or a concussion or an accident of some sort to some degree through neuroplasticity, growing new connections. But they didn't know about neurogenesis until very recently, and they didn't know the significance of neurogenesis until just very, very recently.
I mean, it's really a paradigm shift, isn't it? Because the fact that not only do you have new connections, but what neurogenesis is saying is that whole theory is wrong. We are growing new brain cells all the time, and we now need to know how to support the brain to do that as efficiently as possible.
That's right. It is a paradigm changer, a game changer, a whole new way of looking at the brain. That's right.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's why your book is all about the strategies to help to increase neurogenesis. It's very profound because there are many, many facets of this journey that need to be included in helping to upgrade our brain, so to speak, and keep it functioning. You talk in your book about depression, and I particularly want us to address that point because I think the issue of depression is a really big problem. I think you have some really great statistics which you'll share with us, but also the use of antidepressants, which I have some real problems with, is such a flawed approach to depression and a flawed solution to depression. And I'd like you to elaborate on that a bit more.
Yeah, I'm with you on the reservations around antidepressants completely. So it turns out that at this point, one quarter of American women between the ages of 25 and 45 are taking an antidepressant. I think that's an astonishing statistic,
yeah.
1 in 4.
Yeah.
It is a bigger problem, theoretically, for women than for men. We don't know if this is because men don't report it as much, don't ask for help as much, or just don't recognize it as much, or whether just hormonally or physiologically they are less vulnerable to this. They probably develop other things, but for American women in particular, this is a really big issue. And antidepressants have been marketed in a brilliant way by the pharmaceutical companies for some years now. And it was really research into depression that turned the spotlight onto neurogenesis and the critical role the rate of neurogenesis plays in our mood. So it used to be believed for a very long time, and in fact, it continues to be believed by almost everybody, that depression is the result of low serotonin levels in the brain, that serotonin is this neurotransmitter. And with the discovery of SSRIs, which is selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, beginning with Prozac about 30 years ago, the idea was that with these SSRIs, we can raise the serotonin levels in the brain, and lo and behold, people get undepressed. Well, it turns out antidepressants actually are less effective than most people think. They work in less than 50% of the people who take them. Plus, they've got some pretty severe side effects. Most people who take SSRIs experience different side effects, such as loss of libido, loss of sex drive, which is depressing in itself. And it also turns out that taking SSRIs decreases the number of serotonin receptors in the brain. So the body begins to downregulate the production of serotonin receptors, which makes the person more and more dependent upon serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So what they discovered, this is in the early 2000s, was that the way antidepressants work is not through increasing our serotonin levels, and that, in fact, this whole serotonin deficiency theory is wrong. The way they actually work is by increasing the rate of neurogenesis.
Hmm.
And as we will get into, there are many ways to increase the rate of neurogenesis that are free or which are low cost and which are natural and which don't have side effects. But they did a series of experiments. One was they produced depression in mice, and you know, much of this research is done with different mammals because mammals all have the same brain architecture. We have the same basic three brains, the reptilian brain stem that runs the body, the limbic system or mammalian emotional brain responsible for emotions, and the neocortex, which in human beings is responsible for language, but which all mammals have just different sizes of these three brains. And all mammals have the same neurotransmitters and the same neuropeptides, neuromodulators. So since we can't look at people's brains or do experiments with them in the same way we can with animals, most of what we know about the brain, we know from mammals. So they did this one series of experiments where they depressed some mice, and they've gotten very good at making depressed mice or monkeys or any particular mammal. And they gave them Prozac, they gave them an antidepressant, but they prevented the neurogenesis from happening, the increase in neurogenesis. So the serotonin levels went up, but there was no change in the depression levels. Then they did the opposite experiment, where they allowed the neurogenesis to increase, but they blocked the serotonin. And they found out that the mice got undepressed. And this has been done over and over again, many different times in many different ways. So they realized that actually, rather than low serotonin, what the increase in serotonin does is it boosts the rate of neurogenesis. And that's the key for depression. So this whole serotonin deficiency theory of depression is wrong. And, you know, the pharmaceutical companies know that it's wrong at this point. But they are making $16 billion a year off of antidepressants right now. They've got a good gig going. So the cartels right now know that the theory doesn't work, but they want to sell more product. And they are continuing to market it. They are actually hard at work looking for new drugs to increase the rate of neurogenesis. And when they discover them, we will hear nonstop marketing about it, no doubt. But in the meantime, there are lots of things that will do it naturally without side effects. So this whole depression area is a very big issue. I mean, sometimes antidepressants, I think, are important. They can be lifesavers, but they are terribly abused. They are overprescribed, way, way overprescribed, in my opinion.
And they have so many other side effects. I mean, they can increase metabolic syndrome. They can affect the thyroid, increase breast cancer. Of course, we're not even mentioning the fact that it increases the rates of suicidal ideation or suicidal attempts and homicidal behaviors. I mean, they're very scary drugs, and I just am very frightened by how they are used. And I don't know whether you know this. I'll just throw this in here, but I did some research, a while now, when I discovered that they had created a new category for PMS called PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which is, you probably know this, right? It's a psychiatric condition now. And they only did it for one reason, and that was because Prozac was going generic and they didn't want to lose the patent on it. So they created a new name for Prozac. Yeah. They called it Seraphim. They made it pink. And they now and they made a new condition called PMDD for which they now can prescribe this new form or this, you know, kind of new dressed up in a new form of Prozac to prescribe it to young women who have PMS.
Yeah.
Scary.
It is. And the power of the pharmaceutical companies in psychiatric education is enormous at this point. These are enormous forces at work. And again, they want to continue to sell more product. I actually have a client whose cat is on Prozac right now.
Oh, no.
It's unbelievable. Vets are prescribing it. Yeah, any person can walk into their doctor's office and get a prescription for an SSRI. They prescribe it like candy. It's a bit out of control.
It's totally
And it's sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Ruined so many lives. And that's why this work is so important, because it's really, you know, letting people know that we have options, that there are safe, effective ways, and not only that, we'll get the benefit. I mean, if we can work with strategies that are increasing the neurogenesis in our brain, we're getting smarter and more creative and happier, as well as getting out of that depressive rut in our lives. So
that's right.
Can you talk a bit about Let's talk about the brain and give us an idea of what goes on with the brain, maybe a little bit of the brain structure, the hippocampus, some of the key things we need to know as we explore more deeply this concept of neurogenesis and what we can do to enhance neurogenesis in our lives.
Okay, good. So it turns out that, you know, it's a funny situation with the brain because we want to make new brain cells, but we don't want to make too many because the brain is enclosed in this small space, this bony structure. And so if too many new brain cells are made, it'll squish the brain. And if not enough are made, then the brain deteriorates. So it's kind of a Goldilocks problem. We need to find just the right amount. And so the part of the brain that makes new neurons is called the hippocampus. And actually, we have one on each side of the brain, right and left. We have two hippocampi, although it's usually referred to in the singular. Mm-hmm. And the hippocampus is this crescent moon-shaped structure that is involved in all dimensions of consciousness. So on one end of it, the hippocampus is responsible for processing new memories. It doesn't store new memories, but it processes new memories. It allows new memories to form. So, for example, in Alzheimer's disease, the hippocampus is massively attacked, and the person can't make new memories very well. And it turns out that just about everything in the self depends on memory. Memory is kind of like the linchpin to this whole sense of self. So when memory goes, it's like it pulls out the rug from these other functions, like executive function, like working memory, even emotion regulation. And we see this in Alzheimer's patients, where when the hippocampus is attacked and memories stop being able to be formed, the person's whole sense of self begins to erode. Their impulse control goes haywire. They can't do simple things because they no longer have working memory, which is the capacity to hold several things in your mind at one time. They don't have executive function, which requires working memory for it. So this part of the hippocampus responsible for processing new memories is incredibly important to the higher functions of the self. This end of the hippocampus also is involved with somatic memory and spatial relationships and the body. The other end of the hippocampus goes down into the emotional regions of the brain and is deeply involved in emotion regulation. Now, emotion regulation is, again, one of these major functions of the self and actually one of these major functions of the brain. Emotion regulation is the process of acting in ways to feel better, to feel good, or to reduce feeling bad, to minimize feeling bad. So a good example of unskillful emotion regulation would be alcoholism, right? The alcoholic wakes up in the morning and feels bad and wants to feel better, and so he has a drink. And this results in temporarily feeling a little bit less bad, feels a little more numb. But as you know, it leads to acting in ways that are unskillful, and so the person feels worse and worse and worse. So skillful emotion regulation is relating to our feelings in ways that actually lead to feeling better. And so that means being able to self-regulate, being able to calm down certain feelings of, say, anxiety or fear or stress, and to be able to work with feelings that come up that we need to be aware of. Like, I'm feeling sad about something. Well, maybe that means there's something wrong with my job or my relationship or that there's some meaning to it. So these two ends of the hippocampus, one involved with emotion regulation, particularly the regulation of anxiety, stress, and depression, and the other end involved with the body and with the processing of new memories. This hippocampus, this whole hippocampal axis, is hugely important for the sense of self and for optimal brain function. So what we want is a high rate of neurogenesis along the entire axis of the hippocampus. So SSRIs, for example, only increase the rate of neurogenesis along the emotional side of the hippocampus, which is why we don't get an increase in cognitive capacities with people who are taking antidepressants. Other things increase it along the other end, and some things increase it along both ends. So, and some things, most things, actually, we don't know the effect. We know it increases the rate of neurogenesis. We don't know where on the hippocampus it does this. So that's why we need to have a variety of approaches. And this book is really a holistic approach to brain health and to neurogenesis, meaning body, heart, mind, spirit. Because it turns out that when we stimulate the brain from all of these different ways, all of these different dimensions, body, heart, mind, spirit, they work together synergistically. Whereas if we just do one thing, that has much less effectiveness than doing a number of things working together.
So we'll talk about some of those integrated strategies that you're referring to, but I wanted to ask you, I know I do a lot with stress and the work I do with women, women's health, that's such a big issue, and adrenal exhaustion is such a big issue, and I have been told in the research that one of the consequences of high cortisol levels is the reduction of the hippocampus, so it's reducing our capacity to have access to those stored memories and the other functions you talked about. Do you have any more to add to that?
Yes, this is a huge piece of all this, actually. So in terms of body, heart, mind, spirit, by the heart, what I mean is really the emotional level of our being. And so, again, this is a two-pronged strategy. We need to decrease things or reduce things or stop things that lower our rate of neurogenesis. And we want to increase those activities and nutrients that raise our rate of neurogenesis. And it turns out that chronic stress is one of the most powerful decreasers of neurogenesis. So I think of stress as two kinds of stress, good stress and bad stress. And good stress is short-term stress or moderate stress. And bad stress, unhealthy stress, is chronic stress or really intense stress. And it turns out that this bad stress is one of the worst things for the brain and for the hippocampus in particular. And high levels of cortisol, you're right, they actually are neurotoxic and actually kill neurons in the hippocampus. And they also slow the rate of neurogenesis to a crawl. So good stress we need, you know, sort of like exercising a muscle. When we exercise a muscle, what we're doing is we're stressing it. But then we rest and stop stressing it and allow it to build back up, and it builds back up stronger. And it's the same with stress. Stress is something that we need. We need challenges to make us stronger, to bring forth new capacities within us. But we want optimal stress. We want moderate stress, and we want short-term stress so that the body can return to a homeostatic balance and can feel relaxed again. We get a break from stress. But the type of stress that's in most people's lives right now isn't that. It's chronic stress. And in chronic stress, we get this gradual degradation of the brain, of the immune system, of the cardiovascular system, on so many levels of the body. Chronic stress is very toxic, very dangerous, and particularly when it comes to the brain. So reducing stress and finding alternate ways of dealing with stressful situations. And again, getting a break, meaning allowing the body to come back to a relaxed state where the parasympathetic nervous system responsible for relaxation can kick in. This is hugely important. So identifying the sources of stress, whether it's a job or whether it's certain kinds of relationships or even the internet for that matter. I mean, many people are just always plugged in, always receiving texts or emails from work. And so just unplugging, just get going offline is really helpful for just about all of us. It's almost like when we are always online, it changes the nervous system. It's like we get speedier. It brings us into a more amped up, stressed out place. And one thing I find interesting is that a lot of the CEOs of some of the high-tech companies here in Silicon Valley, like Eric Schmidt and Steve Jobs, they wouldn't, when he was alive, they don't let their kids use their iPads during the week, only during the weekend. And you know, dinners are like no cell phones. It's like we need a break from our electronics because being online all the time is also part of this stress.
I was told that multitasking is also really harmful to the brain.
Yeah, and it turns out that multitasking is really very rapid. It's serial, one at a time. There is really no such thing as multitasking. To do several things at once means you're doing one thing at a time very quickly. So it looks like you're multitasking, and you're really sort of breaking up your attentional capacity at that point. So that's right. When we're rapidly shifting between many different things, that also is a kind of stress to the brain.
Yeah, so interesting. And I've really been aware of trying to reduce my multitasking, but I'll tell you, it's a really challenge. It's a big challenge to do that because we're also plugged into trying to, you know, talk on the phone, check our emails, whatever else we're doing simultaneously.
Right.
And it's turned out to be unproductive, and it must have an impact on our brain as well.
That's right. We get kind of addicted to this dopamine squirt that we get every time a text arrives or an email comes in. It's like, oh boy, what's that? And so it can be hard to unplug. It's like you almost go through a kind of withdrawal. It's like, oh, what's happening here? And that withdrawal, if you can stay with it, it actually then brings you into the world in another way, in a slowed down way.
Yeah. So that kind of allows us to segue into some of the strategies that you have put into your book that you recommend. And I think maybe we should start with some of the strategies that focus on diet and specific nutritional support, and then we can kind of go over onto the lifestyle side of things, which is also quite fascinating.
Sure. Yeah. So, again, there are two things we need to be doing. One, we need to stop eating or reduce eating those things that slow down our rate of neurogenesis and are neurotoxic. And we want to increase those foods and nutrients that increase our rate of neurogenesis. So the book goes into about, 30 or 40 different nutrients that increase our rate of neurogenesis that many people would be advised to at least check out and see how they feel. Let me give you a few of the top ones that I think just about everybody would benefit from. The first one is omega-3 fatty acids. Now, omega-3 fatty acids increase the rate of neurogenesis by 40%, which is quite astonishing. Actually, there are a couple of studies, and one of the directors of the National Institute of Health talked about this. There are some studies to show that high amounts of omega-3s, meaning like 6 to 8 grams a day, are more effective than antidepressants for depression.
Yes.
They are more effective than SSRIs for depression, but with none of the side effects. So that is, I think, an astonishing statistic in itself, that there's a single substance that is more potent than all of these drugs. So when you take omega-3 fatty acids, what you're doing is you are particularly increasing the DHA levels in your brain. So your brain is made up of about two-thirds fat. So one thing we want to be doing is eating a lot of good, healthy fats. You know, if you want to build a high-end house, you need to use high-quality materials. You don't use rotting wood or decaying wood. You use high-quality lumber. And it's the same with the brain. To build a better brain and have a brain that is has an optimal high rate of neurogenesis, that is really flourishing, we need a diet that is high in healthy fats. And the most important of these is DHA. So two-thirds of the brain is fat, and of that, one-third of that fat is DHA. And DHA is one of the three omega-3 fatty acids. So omega-3 fatty acids consist of ALA, EPA, and DHA. And DHA is the one that's most important by far for the brain. So most people will get this through fish oil supplements. And if you do that, you want a fish oil supplement that is high in DHA levels. Some of them are actually misleadingly deceptive and are low in DHA. You want one that has a high DHA level, and also you want one that is molecularly distilled. Otherwise, there's going to be mercury contamination in it. And we don't want that, because mercury is one of the most potent neurotoxins known. So if it's molecularly distilled, it won't have any mercury in it, and we want it with a high DHA level. So most people would benefit by taking 3, 4, 5 grams a day, and they would begin to notice both an antidepressant and anti-stress, anti-anxiety effect, as well as an increase in memory, probably within 3 or 4 weeks. You know, that was the other thing with antidepressants. They didn't understand why it took 3 or 4 weeks for antidepressants to work. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as you start taking an SSRI, your serotonin levels go up immediately, within hours. You have much higher rates of serotonin in your blood than in your brain. Well, it turns out 3 or 4 weeks is how long it takes new brain cells to mature and to come online. And that's when we see the antidepressant boost at that point. So some people can get enough omega-3 strictly through eating a lot of fish. They did this one study where they looked at people who ate 1 to 3 servings of fish a week. And they found out that they had 16% more gray matter. They had 16% more neurons in the higher processing centers of the brain, unless they ate fried fish, in which case there was no difference. So
these would have to be oily fishes, right? I mean, those that have
a good amount of omega-3.
Yeah.
That's right, like wild-caught salmon.
Yeah.
Right, or sable fish, yes. And so frying foods gives us unhealthy fats. It's like we want to decrease unhealthy, bad fats, and we want to increase healthy, good fats. So unhealthy, bad fats are any kind of fried food or cooking in vegetable oil. You know, we've been told for decades we should all be cooking with vegetable oil. It turns out it's not true, that cooking with vegetable oil oxidizes the fats. So an oxidized fat is one that has become rancid through overheating or through light. And when that oxidized fat enters your body when it's consumed and assimilated and gets into your bloodstream, what it does is it oxidizes the cholesterol in your bloodstream. And it's this oxidized cholesterol that produces heart disease, atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries, and it also produces inflammation. And inflammation is another one of these poisons for the brain. A high degree of inflammation slows your rate of neurogenesis way down. So you want to eat an anti-inflammatory diet, not a pro-inflammatory diet. So you want to not cook with vegetable oils. You want to not eat any kind of fried food. And you want to eat good, healthy fats. So things like avocados, nuts, or when we cook, cook with coconut oil or butter or ghee or tallow or lard. Cooking with saturated fats is the best way to cook because they don't go rancid. They've got a very high smoke point, so we can cook with them quite easily. But cooking even with olive oil is better used cold on salads than cooked with, because it also has a pretty low smoke point. If you do cook with it, good to cook with it at very low temperatures.
So I have a couple of questions. Do you recommend just getting DHA supplements that are just DHA to increase the DHA levels, or should they?
If you can, but most of the fish oils out there have a mix of EPA and DHA, but there are some that are higher in DHA. Life Extension makes a good one. Now makes a good one, and Nordic Naturals actually, I just saw, has a new one that has a very high DHA content to it, which is great. All of these are molecularly distilled. And some people are vegetarians and don't do fish oil. And they've been told to do flax oil or chia seed oil. And it turns out that actually doesn't work. That flax oil has a lot of ALA in it. And the body will convert ALA to DHA, but very, very inefficiently. Something like 5% or 7% of it in healthy 18-year-olds gets converted, and it goes down from there. So they've tried to increase DHA levels in the blood and the brain through supplementation with flax oil, and they've been unsuccessful. They haven't moved the needle at all. So if you're vegetarian, the only way that thus far it appears you can get DHA is through the algae form of DHA. So there's an algae form of omega-3, which is actually EPA. And EPA does convert to DHA pretty readily. So they've successfully raised DHA levels by supplementing with this algae form of omega-3.
And that's what you would recommend for vegetarians and vegans?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. You know, and I think that if you're vegetarian or vegan, this is the biggest problem. It's your brain. Your brain is going to be suffering unless you do something to make sure you're getting DHA. They did this one set of experiments with monkeys where they raised a group on a low omega-3 diet, and they raised another set on a high omega-3 diet. And then they looked at their brains, and they found out that those monkeys on the low omega-3 diet had very simple, undifferentiated brains, whereas those on the high omega-3 diet had very complex, richly differentiated brains. And when it comes to the brain, complexity is good. The high omega-3 group, they had brains that were complex, almost like human beings. And that's what we want to see. So if you're vegetarian, you need to make extraordinary measures to make sure you get enough DHA, because your brain is going to be suffering without that.
So is algae able to do that, or do you have to take high amounts of the algae? What do vegans and vegetarians, which I, you know, this conversation goes on all the time with my patients. I see them so deficient in so many key nutrients because they just can't get in their diet. Can they successfully acquire the amount of DHA and EPA through just the algae, in your experience?
Yes. It does look like they are able to do that, but they need to take quite a bit. Yes.
Okay. Okay. How about give us, I know there's a lot of other great things I want to cover in our conversation, but I know you are a big fan of blueberries, so maybe we can just add more of the physical strategies or nutritional strategies, and we'll go into some of the others as well.
So that's right. Blueberries are like Miracle-Gro for the brain. The brain just explodes with new neurons. With blueberries. It's antioxidants, they are anti-inflammatory, and there's new evidence to show that blueberries may actually increase working memory, which is one of the most difficult things to increase. Almost nothing increases working memory. So it's been able to actually reverse some cognitive decline in some studies. Blueberries are one of the best things you can do. Now, when you do blueberries, doing like a cup a day is the equivalent that will show good results in increase in neurogenesis and brain health. And you can do either fresh blueberries, or you can do frozen blueberries, or you can do blueberry as an extract, as a dried extract through a capsule. And it turns out that if you're interested in increasing your glucose metabolism, which probably most people should be interested in, because most people are insulin resistant to some degree, then it turns out that using the extracts is better than even fresh blueberries. And you can also get them even when they're out of season. So doing, I don't know, 4 or 5 capsules a day can be very, very powerful for the brain, very, very helpful.
And I also use blueberry concentrate as a juice.
Yes.
So it comes in a concentrate form, and you just add more water, and you can make it to whatever strength you want. But that's another great way.
Yeah, that is. That's great. And let me just throw out one more nutrient here, which is hesperidin. Hesperidin is a bioflavonoid from citrus fruits. And they've discovered how it works. It works by increasing the survival rate of new neurons. So if you do, for example, omega-3s, that, again, the brain takes off making new brain cells, but about 50% of them die pretty soon. The brain prunes them pretty quickly, unless we do other things that increase the survival rate. So hesperidin is one of those things that increases the survival rate to almost 100%.
Wow.
So hesperidin is just another good thing to have in there. You can do it as a standalone supplement as well.
Can you do it by having more citrus fruits in your diet as well, or eating the inside peels of it perhaps?
Yeah. Again, there might be a danger of doing too much sugar if you do that, because the other big sort of neurotoxic dietary lifestyle that most people are caught up in is too much sugar.
Yeah.
Turns out that a high sugar diet will slow down the rate of neurogenesis by 50%.
Rate
of neurogenesis in two.
Do you think that, this is kind of your opinion I'm asking for, this growing incidence of dementia and Alzheimer's and all sorts of other neurological diseases, do you see a correlation to the diet and the exposure to toxins that we have been surrounding ourselves and living in for a generation or two?
Yeah, absolutely. More and more it seems like Alzheimer's is really a lifestyle issue more than anything else. you know, it's a huge problem right now. 1 in 3 seniors dies now, either with Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia.
Yeah.
And the Alzheimer's Association, on their website, says that within a few years, 50% of people reaching the age of 85 will have Alzheimer's. And since most of us are expected to live to be 85, that gives us a 50-50 chance of developing Alzheimer's. This is a huge problem. And right now, also on the Alzheimer's Association website, it says this is the only major disease for which there's currently no treatment, no cure, no prevention. There is nothing that conventional medical science can do. And the pharmaceutical companies have now spent literally billions of dollars trying to come up with drugs. There have been hundreds and hundreds of drug trials trying to come up with something that will either delay it or prevent it or cure it, and it's been a complete, utter failure. We've come up with nothing so far, zero. However, it now turns out that a holistic lifestyle approach is actually showing the first bit of hope for Alzheimer's. So most research is done by pharmaceutical companies or by academic researchers trying to find the next new drug that they can make a fortune on. Nothing wrong with that, that's fine. Very little research gets done from a holistic perspective because most of the things are free. There's no drug you can patent there. But there's a few places doing it. There's a place here in California called the Buck Institute on Aging. And late last year, just before my book came out, they published a study which showed, using a holistic approach, that what they did, it was kind of a very simplified version of what is in the book, but a body, heart, mind, spirit approach. What they found is that they were able to reverse the cognitive decline associated with Alzheimer's in people who had to stop working because of impairments in their memory. They were able to regain their memory through this holistic approach and continue working for the 2 years that they followed them on this study. This is the first bit of glimmer of hope for Alzheimer's. And just a few months ago, in the British medical journal Lancet, some Finnish researchers published the first randomized controlled study of an at-risk for cognitive decline population. And again, doing a very super simplified version of what's in the book, found that they were able to prevent cognitive decline in this at-risk population for the 2 years that they followed them. So right now, it appears as if a holistic approach to brain health is the only thing in which there's actual hope against Alzheimer's, that Alzheimer's is more and more clearly a lifestyle disease. And some people are talking about Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes, that it's a failure in glucose metabolism. And if you actually look at people's glucose levels, right, like something like 50 to 80% of the population of America right now has some degree of insulin tolerance. Their body does not respond to insulin optimally the way it should. They are resistant to it. The cells make fewer insulin receptors. And so there's extra insulin in the system, which is very damaging to the system. And there's extra glucose, higher glucose levels in the body as well. And those higher glucose levels, you can actually track glucose levels and cognitive decline just about perfectly. That the higher our level of blood glucose, blood sugar, the faster our rate of cognitive decline and the lower the rate of neurogenesis. So I think a good test for just about everybody to have is a hemoglobin A1C, which measures your glucose levels for the past 3 months. It's like an average over the last 3 months. And if you show any degree of insulin resistance, anything above 4.5, 4.6, which just about everybody has to some degree, then it would be wise to work on lowering your insulin resistance and getting your blood sugar down just for the sake of your brain.
So you have so many other great things that we're not going to have time to get into, but maybe we can just very briefly touch on the things that you write about, based on the research you've included in the book, that contributes to neurogenesis. So why don't we just kind of go through them, really just list them basically, because we only have a few minutes left. But I just want people to understand that there are many strategies that really have a huge impact on our brain's ability to regenerate itself, and we need to start implementing them right now in our lives.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That Alzheimer's is a disease that begins decades before we see any symptoms. So now is the time. That's right. And I guess one other thing, this isn't just about preventing Alzheimer's. It's actually about operating at a higher level right now. So, yes, so there are body, heart, mind, spirit. There's a chapter on each of those, and there's a separate chapter on diet, because diet is such a big part of this. So on the physical level, there are many things we can do that increase our rate of neurogenesis. Getting a good night's sleep is one of them. When we don't get enough sleep, and this ties in with stress as well, the rate of neurogenesis goes down, along with our immunity. There are numerous emotional factors. There are numerous mental factors, mostly relating to new learning, using our brain, using our minds. When we use it, when we use our minds in different ways, we exercise different functions. So a lot of these different, like, computer games or brain games, there turned out the research shows they're not terribly effective because they don't generalize to the rest of the brain. We need to use our brain in a number of different ways, which means we need to be lifelong learners. So listening to a broadcast like this is good for your brain. You're learning new things, and that increases your rate of neurogenesis.
There you go. More reason to listen to this show.
Right.
But you also talk about the role of exercise. I think we have to just really emphasize how important exercise is. And I've been learning some swing dance, so learning things like that have movement to physical things that you're learning is also really important, isn't it?
That's right. And, you know, any exercise is good for the body. Yoga, weightlifting, aerobic exercise. But in terms of neurogenesis, the only form of exercise that seems to be really effective is aerobic exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So aerobic exercise is anything that gets you breathing hard. So swing dancing, fast dancing, running, walking quickly, biking, swimming, walking up a hill, anything that gets you breathing fast, again, the rate of neurogenesis just takes off when we have this kind of exercise. Three times a week, better is five or six times a week.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very helpful for the brain.
You know, Dr. Courtright, I'm going to have to bring this to a conclusion, unfortunately, because we're at the end of the show. But I do want to thank you for this great information, and I really want to encourage all my listeners to pick up a copy of your book, The Neurogenesis Diet and Lifestyle. You can go to Dr. Brant Courtright's website, and I'm sure you can pick it up on Amazon. But it's just, I find your book so easy to read. It has such great information, practical strategies, which I always like. And I learned a lot by going through your book and, just taking the opportunity to learn for myself. So I really want to thank you for the tremendous amount of research you have done to put it together in a manner that's really easy for us to understand. Thank you so much.
McGray, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with
you. Thank you. And to all my listeners, thank you. And remember, take care of your brain. Get those new brain cells growing. And until next time, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.